This episode of Cast and Blast Conversations is brought to you by Harrell Adjusting Services, harrelladjusting.com. That's H-A-R-R-E-L-L, adjusting.com. Craig Harrell, friend of the show, longtime listener, fan, 863-559-3405. You can call or you can check them out online. If you have any kind of insurance claim and you want the help of a public adjuster and making sure that you get the most back, he doesn't get paid unless you get paid. You can go to his website and read testimonial after testimonial from satisfied customers. And if you, like I said, if you, it's hurricane season, flag that name, flag that website. You may need them in the future. I hope not, but if you do, that's why folks like Craig do what they do. So HarrellAdjustingServices.com. Today is part two of my visit to CCA Florida a few weeks back. We're sitting down with Frank Guidas today. If you want to go back and hear part one, that's with Lisa Fitzgerald about the CCA Star Tournament. And today we spent some time with Frank talking about CCA's habitat and restoration programs. That's a great opportunity to hear all about all the work this NGO is doing in the state, all around the state, working on water quality, working on improving just ecosystems. I couldn't believe some of the stuff. Like, I learned a lot in this podcast. So hope you guys enjoy it. We got Frank Guidas, CCA Florida, coming at you right now. Frank, how are you?
Good.
Good. Thank you for doing this, man. It's going to be fun, I hope. We'll see. Who is, everybody gets the same first question. And for you, that is, who is Frank Guidas?
Well, first and foremost, I would say that I'm a huge outdoorsman. Always have been since I was a little kid, born and raised here in Florida. I'm also been married for 26 years. I'm a father of three kids, two in college and one in high school. And I've been really happy to be able to share my passion for the outdoors with them and my wife as well. And they're actually one of the big reasons I got into working for CCA.
Okay. Hobbies? Got any hobbies?
Oh, absolutely. Anything that has to do with the outdoors. Fishing, definitely first and foremost. I do a lot of camping. I do a lot of hiking. I do. I like to shrimp during the season. We dip net shrimp over in the Oak Hill area. Anything to do with the outdoors, I absolutely love. I'm a big hunter. I hunt every year up in South Carolina.
Deer hunter.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Uh-huh. And you're also experimenting now. I think you said you're experimenting now with jerky. Is that right?
I am. I bought a jerky gun and I'm experimenting with some flavors. My first batch, I actually mixed venison with ground beef and it came out pretty good.
Did it?
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to just ask for a recipe real quick. Like, do you add like spices and stuff into it? Like
I do. I just found a recipe
okay,
that
you
I like.
Google.
And yeah, I just found a recipe. And then I altered a little bit because I like it a little hotter than most people do. So.
You went up on the spice meter.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay, the first couple of questions we have to ask everybody, and then we'll get back into kind of what you do professionally and CCA and the whole nine yards. But we have to ask these two questions because it basically establishes your credibility. And the first one is, how do you feel about pineapple on a pizza? Does it elicit a strong emotional response, or are you apathetic? Like, where are you at on pineapple on a pizza?
Absolutely love it, and I love it more. I love it more for those little ham and onion with it.
Yeah, we're going to have to end the podcast. I'm sorry.
Just being honest.
Let's say straight up, you can't have a wrong opinion, but that is the wrong opinion on it. What about this? You said you're a fisherman. You said you're a hunter. What's your go-to snack on the boat? Go-to snack in the woods? What's always in your bag?
Beef jerky.
100%?
Just about every time.
I would guess if we've done 50 of these interviews, 47 of them have been beef jerky. That's like the pumpkin spice latte of...
You know, you don't have to refrigerate it. It's got a lot of protein, you know, everything you need to keep you going.
But you don't get too spicy when you're going to be in the woods all day. That could lead to some terrible situations.
That's backfired before.
Same for when you're fishing?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. Nothing wrong with that. We talked about that we hunt, that you hunt, that you fish, and we alluded to the fact that you work for CCA Florida. Who are you professionally? Like kind of what's your background?
Okay. So, my background is in environmental science. I was an environmental scientist for 24 years. I worked for one of the largest firms in the world, Tetra Tech, and did that for about 16, 17 years. And then I had my own consulting firm for 7 years before coming to CCA. So my background is real strong in working with like wetland mitigation, wetland enhancement, upland enhancement, listed species studies, you know, like your gopher tortoises and bald eagles and sand skinks and things like that. Anything to do with the environment. I did a lot of work with groundwater contamination and remediating groundwater contamination. So it was kind of a wide array of stuff. But so I've been given the opportunity to kind of combine that background with my passion of fishing and diving and the coast. So
you're a diver?
Absolutely. Been diver since I was 16.
Spear fisherman or just
no,
a...
No, I've never done that.
Just kind of a recreational diver.
Recreational diver, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Coral reef guy?
Like you absolutely. There's something about as soon as you stick your head under the water and everything goes silent and you're just in another world, that experience you just can't describe unless you do it. I mean...
That's very cool. Now, I think you may have mentioned this, but if you didn't, you are a native Floridian?
I am.
Okay. Born and raised...
Orlando.
In Orlando.
Yep.
Has that changed at all in your lifetime?
No. Actually, I was born in Winter Park, which is right outside of Orlando. But no, except for a little 3-month move that I did up to Vermont during the wintertime because I love to snow ski, I packed my stuff and moved back to Florida and never tried that again.
What about people-wise? Has the amount of people you see around you changed at all?
Oh, good Lord, yes. Yeah, as you know, and it's growing every day. And actually, you know, it's not just Orlando. It's everywhere in Florida, and that's probably our number one problem that we have with the environment.
So what – and we've talked off air a little bit about this kind of pre-gaming, what we were going to talk about, but what was it that attracted you to CCA Florida, Coastal Conservation Association Florida?
Well, I first became a member in 1988. I was invited by a fishing buddy of mine. And he had told me about the advocacy that they do and working towards the healthy fish stocks and things like that. And at the time, other than redfish, at least where I was fishing in Mosquito Lagoon, there weren't, you know, a whole lot of problems. But back then, I did see the netters out there quite a bit. And what was happening is you got these huge schools that we were fishing just like everybody else was, but the netters could just circle them up and wipe them out, you know, all at once. And so we knew it was becoming a big problem. And so that's why I got involved in CCA to begin with. And then over the years, it's evolved into, you know, the habitat and everything else that they do now.
But you were a member long before, because you, how long have you worked here?
I've only worked here 5 years. I've been a member since 88. So
30 plus years.
Yeah. Before the net ban. Yeah.
Wow. Which the net ban historically was like the landmark thing for CCA. If you're not from Florida or you're not familiar with it, like the net ban was just a huge... I did my senior report on the net ban
right.
In high school. Like it was a momentous thing. You recreate primarily like East Coast, or do you kind of go?
Both.
Okay.
Both East Coast, West Coast, but mainly in Central Florida. I fished the Titusville down to Vero area, and then on the West Coast, Crystal River, Homosassa.
It's not important, but I think it is important for some of our listeners because it's always key to know that the scientists or whoever you're talking to, they are recreating in the same spot. Like, it makes it more tangible, right?
Oh, yeah,
that's
absolutely.
That's a term that I love, yeah. But it's true.
Absolutely.
You understand the lagoon and the estuaries and the... And then in your habitat work, was that in that same region or was that all over?
It included that area, but the entire state of Florida.
Okay. Like, yeah. There was nowhere...
The coastal state. Yeah, the coastal.
Mostly coastal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's talk... Before we talk about the work CCA Florida is doing, and maybe this blends together with that as we talk through it, but... What are some of the major issues you see Florida facing habitat-wise or ecologically that we got to address? Like, what do you see?
Well, I mean, certainly, and everybody realizes what's going on with our water quality around the state, the algae blooms, the red tide, the fish kills. I mean, we have a fish kill in Biscayne Bay right now, and it's not an overnight fix, and that's the one thing I think people really have a hard time understanding that we're in this for the long term and we will fix it, but we're in it for the long term. But that's the biggest issues, I think, around the state right now and what we need to do. And if you look at somebody like Tampa Bay, who's really a success story, they started taking a watershed approach first and working, fixing the problems on land before, you know, they really homed in on fixing the problems in the water and redoing the seagrass and things like that. But we have to start on land first. And
explain what you mean by that. They took a watershed approach first.
So, you know, any toilet you flush that is going to go downhill into Tampa Bay, or any drop of oil that comes from a car or gasoline or something that might hit the road or go into the groundwater or something like that, it flows downhill. It's eventually going to end up in the bay, whether it gets there via a creek or a canal or directly into the bay itself. And it's such a broad area. The cumulative effect of all that is significant. And back in the 50s and 60s and even 70s, I guess, is when the seagrass just, you know, almost completely died off. You know, that's when it was, I think, realized over there. So they really took a hard look, kind of like Chesapeake Bay is doing, kind of the same thing. And they started uphill and worked down, which is what we need to do. Infrastructure, you know, replacing old infrastructure, outdated, replacing the septic tanks that need to be replaced, especially close to areas that lead into the rivers and canals and whatnot. But that's got to be addressed first. Pesticides, I mean, you know.
They didn't just run plant seagrass thinking, oh, this will save the problem. They address the problem at its
right.
root causes.
Yeah, because I mean, seagrass planting, you know, because you mentioned that, is it's slow, it takes a long time, and it's expensive. So there'd be no need to plant seagrass in an area that's just going to continue to be hit with, you know, poor water quality. So
let's talk about your role now. What do you do for CCA Florida? What is your?
So I'm the Director of Habitat and Environmental Restoration.
Okay.
And
what does that mean?
Basically, anything related to habitat restoration, water quality, things of that nature, I'm involved with. And the goal of the organization when I was hired back in 2015 is to really increase the habitat projects and help, you know, because when you do that, you're helping with the water quality. You're helping clean the water quality. That was the goal, is to do that when I was hired. And kind of a, I guess as an example that I could give you would be like from CCA Florida was founded in 1985, and from 85 to 2014, the organization had completed 3 artificial reefs.
Okay.
And then from 2015 until now, we've done 17. So
wow.
We've really turned it around, and the habitat numbers are even bigger, the oyster restoration, seagrass plantings, living shorelines, that kind of stuff. So in my opinion, this is my opinion, but to me, this habitat restoration, the stuff that's going on now, is equally as significant as the net ban back in the early 90s.
So I want to talk, do you mind going through some of these kind of projects? And they could either be a specific project or an example of kind of oyster restoration or restocking or artificial. Like I'd like to kind of go through some of those and explain how that works. Like,
yeah, absolutely. So, well, let me start, I guess, with, we have our own oyster recycling program at CCA.
Okay.
And so we have a couple of restaurants that are donating the oysters every week. They're taken out to the Lake County landfill, which is in Astatula in the center of the state. So it's easy for us to take those oysters anywhere in the state and deploy them. And we allow them to dry out for 6 months to get all of the organisms out of there that we don't want to transplant to another water body. And then those oysters are put back in the water, and then it creates a new reef. The oyster larvae will come along, attach to the shells we put back in the water, and grow a whole new reef on top of that. And we've done that all over the state. As far south as actually Broward County, we have a pilot oyster project going on in Broward County to try to restore oysters back to Broward. And as you probably know, there are no real living oyster reefs in Broward County right now.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's crazy.
The oysters that you see in Broward County are going to be on the seawalls and on the mangrove roots and stuff like that. But there's really no living reefs down there. And a lot of that is you know, back to water quality and population.
Are you guys doing anything in Apalachicola?
Well, we're not doing anything in Apalachicola as far as restoration work. But I serve on the advisory committee for the Apalachee Bay System Initiative.
Okay, that's what I was thinking of. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I've been part of that for the last year, and we're working on a management plan for the bay and how to help restore and you know, a sustainable oyster harvest for wild oysters.
Right. I think that's a compelling thing, because everyone's in, you know, it's a root problem, right? If we can fix oysters, you can greatly improve water quality.
Absolutely.
Am I saying that well?
Oh yeah, I mean, they're filter feeders. Yes, definitely.
What about artificial reefs? Explain to me how you guys are involved there.
So kind of the same thing, artificial reefs, you know, you have a lot of marine life and things that will attach to those. A lot of them are filter feeders, but it's by creating these artificial reefs, and when these things are created and permitted, they're put in areas that are completely barren. It has to be on a sandy, barren bottom, no life at all. You can't have any kind of hard bottom or any kind of growth whatsoever, seagrass or coral or you know, anything like that. And so these, when you put the materials down, whether it be concrete or a vessel or something like that, it makes an immediate impact. Fish come within hours to the reef.
Really?
Absolutely. And then so over the years it grows and becomes a living, viable ecosystem. And there's a lot of benefits to that, because not only are you providing, say, a place for smaller fish to grow up, you're also relieving pressure on other reef sites. Say, you know, the issues we're having with the coral reefs in Southeast Florida, by creating an artificial reef, you're actually taking pressure off of some of these.
By managing, like, fishing pressure? Is that what you mean?
Or? Everything, yes. Absolutely, yeah.
Or also, like, pressure just ecologically?
All the above. Diving, everything. It creates a new habitat that people are, you know, will come and visit and fish and dive on and whatnot. So,
How about, you guys do mangrove replanting?
We do. We do mangrove. We do seagrass. Normally that's associated with a living shoreline.
Okay.
Where you have, you put a combination of, say, your oyster bags would be out in the deeper water to kind of help with the wave break and whatnot. And then inside of that would be like a spartina grass or some kind of grass to help stabilize the shoreline. And then behind that would be your mangroves or, you know, so it's a really effective way that to stabilize the shoreline, which we're doing all over the state. Most of our projects are done through partnerships.
Yeah, talk about that. How does that
well, work? It's a great way to, you know, get more bang for your buck, to get more done, get bigger areas done, leverage the funding. And so, like, we do a lot of work with University of Central Florida over Mosquito Lagoon. We've donated money to them, volunteers, materials. We've donated oyster shells, things like that. And same with different organizations all around the state of Florida. And so it's really a good way to, you know, take a small amount of money and you know, quadruple it. And, you know, depending on how many partners you have or grants that you might get for that project. And then you're really making a big difference.
Hit me with, we had lunch before we started recording. You hit us with a dollars in the water number. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, so since 2010, CCA Florida and our National Habitat Program, the Building Conservation Trust, have put $800,000 into habitat projects in Florida alone. And we've leveraged that $800,000 to almost $4.9 million in habitat projects.
Through grants or partnerships or whatever?
Grants, mainly partnerships, but also through grants. Absolutely, yep.
So that's almost $500,000 a year if you averaged it out over. That's a substantial amount of habitat restoration.
It is. And the number's growing exponentially. I mean, every year we're doing more and more, getting more and more partners and doing more and more, you know, projects.
Now, are you also involved in, like, the restocking efforts?
We are. The redfish restocking and some snook restocking that we've done. I'm not as connected with the restocking program as some of the others at CCA Florida. But I will mention that one of the things we're working on now is a large grant up in the Panhandle to release 50,000 juvenile redfish.
Oh, wow.
And we'll find out about that in October. But yeah, so CCA's done quite a bit of redfish releases on the west coast of Florida, and this year working on a restocking program on the east coast.
How would you, and this is a hard question, how would you state or what are CCA's positions on, like, water quality? I mean, do you guys have a position on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have a position on water quality. We have a committee that is just all about water quality. Like, we have a habitat committee, a water quality committee. And we have a lot of people who are very well connected with, you know, the issues. And a lot of them are have advanced degrees in fields related to water quality. And so, yeah, of course, we're following it very closely. Like, for instance, we were big supporters of the Brevard County half-cent sales tax,
right?
Which is just an incredible project. What they're doing over there is phenomenal. But we try to support anything like that, the restoration work. We like to see it done the right way. People have to understand that a lot of times there's no quick fix to some of these solutions. You know, it took decades to create some of these problems, and it's just going to take decades to resolve them. Like I said before, the infrastructure, we have got to address that. We've got to address updating our wastewater treatment plants and our septic tanks and really look at curbing fertilizers during the summer and things like that. So
what is, and I won't make you pick just one, so if you've got a couple, give us some examples of some of your favorite projects you guys have worked on.
Oh, wow. There's been a lot. I would say one of my current favorites, and it's because of the incredible public reception we've got from this project, is we're doing a pilot oyster project down in Broward County. And what that involves is it's all volunteer. And we have 100 volunteers that live on the water in the Fort Lauderdale area that have they're called oyster catchers. And it's basically roughly a cement slurry patty that's about, 12 inches in diameter, maybe a little bit bigger. And it's hung at the right interval from their docks. And what we're trying to do is get oyster growth on them and any other marine growth. And then
hung in what way? Like hanging off their docks?
Yeah, it's hanging off their docks on a rope, okay. Basically. And it's right at the same level that you might see oysters already growing on a seawall or something like that at the intertidal level. And then the volunteers are taking them out of the water once a month and photographing both sides for us. And then we're also doing water quality sampling down there with salinity and temperature, and just trying to get a handle on where we might have areas that oysters will grow well. And we are finding a few bright spots, and we're kind of just into it. We're kind of just getting our feet wet on that. But we're really hopeful that this is going to turn out to be something where we can find an area that we can actually transplant these oysters and create a new living reef in Broward County.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of water quality issues down there as well. And so anything we can do to, to help, we're going to try to do.
No, that's fascinating about Broward. I was today years old when I learned it didn't have oysters, like real oysters there. What are some others that you guys have been working on that stick out?
Yeah, so one of the artificial reef projects that really stands out to me is on the southwest coast off of Gasparilla Pass is the Phoenix Reef. And we made our first deployment on the Phoenix Reef in November of 2018, and we'll be making the second deployment this year. And what's fascinating about that reef is it really involves the local community. The funds that were raised came from folks like Ingman Marine, who made a very large donation and have committed to donating every year to that project with the goal of adding to it every year and making it one of the biggest reefs in Southwest Florida. And so that's been a fantastic project. We've had the materials donated to that, some really high quality concrete, which makes great artificial reefs. You get growth on it immediately. We have some underwater footage of that reef, which is actually on our YouTube channel. And it's amazing how quickly that fish came to that reef, and we have groupers and snappers and everything, taken over there. So that's a really big success story and something that we're going to keep going year after year.
What's a deployment? Use the term deployment. You said we've done one deployment now.
Deployment is just basically the placing of approved artificial reef materials on the bottom.
Okay. And do you guys, when you guys do that, you partner with like state agencies, or how does that work? Like, do you have to permit that?
It has to be permitted. So in the state of Florida, they don't give artificial reef permits to private individuals or business. It has to go through a county or a city.
Okay.
So the for instance, Lee County had that permit already in place.
Gotcha.
And so we were able to make the first deployment on that artificial reef. So
that was important for me to ask, because I don't want people to think they can go deploy artificial reefs.
Right.
So I wanted to clear that up. What is the Ghost Trap Rodeo? I have a note here. Ghost Trap Rodeo. What is that?
Yeah. So the Ghost Trap Rodeo, we partnered with OceanAid 360, and they're from St. Petersburg area. And actually, Captain Neil Hollins is the director of that. And We partnered with them on a grant from NOAA. It was a marine debris removal grant. And this was in 2018, 2019. We won the grant. And what we did is we removed derelict crab traps from Tampa Bay over a period of several. We had several events where we had people come out to one location at a boat ramp. We talked to them on what traps they were allowed to touch and which ones they couldn't. They would go out, collect the traps and any other marine debris that they found, and would bring it back, and we would give prizes out, and it's like a fishing tournament, but with marine debris, really cool events. And what I really like about that is the crab traps were cleaned, and they were repurposed and recycled to use for oyster restoration up in the northeast part of Florida. And so we actually this week found out that we just won that grant again. And we will be doing it instead of just one location. We're going to do it in seven locations around the state. And that'll kick off in January of 2021.
So you're going to have these tournaments again. And I'm guessing that'll be on ccaflorida.org. They could go there and find out details about it as it gets closer.
Definitely, yes.
And explain that to me. Like, how does that work? You take a trap out. How do you put oysters on it? Or how do you get oysters to grow to it?
Well, so they don't do this method all over the state. The Northeast Florida up near the Carolinas, it seems to be the most effective. So once the trap is cleaned completely, it's dipped into this cement slurry. And I don't know exactly what else is in there, but it's dipped into a cement slurry. And then the traps are locked together, and they're placed in the intertidal zone along a shoreline.
So and they basically look like panels?
Basically,
you're not putting them back out there as a whole trap, is that right, or is it still a square, a cube?
It's still a cube.
Oh, it is. Yeah, okay.
It's still a cube, and they're.
I'm trying to visualize it.
Yeah, and so they're locked together in rows basically, and the oysters love them. The oysters will gravitate to them and grow a whole new reef on top of them.
Forgive me for my naivety because I'm around oysters a lot. How does that work? Do oysters like? Oyster larva? Is it oyster spat? Is that the
right
term?
Exactly, yeah. When the oysters spawn, the oyster spat is moved through the water, through the tide.
It just floats.
And it floats, and it's either looking for its host shell, another oyster shell, or some similar type of material that it can attach to and grow. And so it grows an entire new oyster. Some people think we recycle these oyster shells, put them back in the water, and those oyster shells grow an oyster or something. It doesn't work that way. It's actually there to attract the oyster spat, which will attach to that shell and grow a whole new shell. And then, you know, one after another, it starts to form a reef.
But in the ghost trap situation, you're dipping it in a concrete slurry and building these basically structures mm-hmm. that oysters are prone to stick to.
Correct.
Am I saying that right?
That's correct.
Okay. I'm trying to make sure I understand that.
Yeah, and they're placed in areas where we know the water quality is good, where we know there's going to be oyster spat available. If we were just to put them out anywhere, it's not going to be successful. So there's a lot of work. There's a lot of planning that goes into picking the locations.
I have a note about clam restoration. Do you guys do clam restoration? And how is that different than oyster restoration?
Well, it's a lot different than oyster restoration. The clams are on the bottom and often in deeper water. Three years ago, I want to say, we teamed up with Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission and University of Florida on a grant to do clam restoration in the Indian River Lagoon. And the first year we applied, we weren't ranked high enough to get the grant. So we actually, CCA was contacted by Blair Wiggins from Addictive Fishing.
Yep.
He had already noticed a correlation between the clams disappearing and the water quality really dropping off quick in the Indian River. And so we got together and started raising funds privately for this project. And then I think that was the key that caught the attention of the grant committee the next year we applied, and we won the grant the next year over $100,000 to do this project. And so what it basically is they're taking what we're calling super clams. We're taking these large clams that are still alive in the Indian River that have lived through all the brown tides and the terrible water quality conditions, and University of Florida Whitney Lab is spawning these and growing new clams. And then once these clams reach a certain size, we're putting them back into the Indian River.
Okay. So basically you're taking good genetics
exactly,
of clams?
Exactly.
And how is that? It's because where clams grow is different? Sorry, I'm not a clam guy. I know the oysters grow kind of in oyster bars. Clams don't grow that way, right? They
don't actually form they don't grow together like an oyster bar would, but they form these beds basically on the bottom. And the clams are all over the place, but we're trying to focus on the Indian River because of the poor water quality
right.
in the areas, the central portion, the north portion of the river, where we know the clams are going to do well.
I've seen the example before where they throw oysters into a murky aquarium and it cleans it. Clams filter the same way?
They do, not as much. Okay. A lot of people say a full-grown oyster can filter up to 50 gallons of water a day. That may be true. It may be slightly less, but it's a lot. It's significant. The clams are less than that. I don't know the exact number.
Okay.
But
if you get
still
enough of
filter
them out
feeders,
there.
Absolutely, and they're filtering the pollutants and everything else out of the water, and then especially as they grow bigger and bigger, it's just more and more. So,
Is there a correlation between clams and seagrass?
Oh, absolutely. It's like a lot of other,
like indicator type species.
Yeah, it's a symbiotic relationship. The clams are going to filter the water. Seagrass needs clear water to grow. It needs enough light to get to the bottom, in order to grow. So as those clams are filtering the water and cleaning it up, there's more sunlight coming down and the grass is able to grow.
So I become a CCA member. How is that connected to what's happening here, the work you're doing, habitat restoration?
Right. So when you become a CCA member, first of all, it opens up a lot of doors for you to help volunteer on projects. For instance, we send a weekly email out to our membership, and any volunteering opportunities that are available are on there. But also your membership and any other funding that we receive, a portion of that goes back to habitat restoration. So that's where we get a lot of our funding for these projects. And then that's where I'm able to take a certain amount of money and leverage it and really do some really big projects. So every single membership is critical.
Crucial to being able to turn that, I forget what you said, 800,000 into 4.9 million?
Right. And what we've seen lately, and this is what I was really hoping for when I was hired 5 years ago, is we're now seeing a portion of our membership that don't fish. They're on board with us because of the habitat restoration is important to them.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
That's intriguing. Like that you think of CCA as strictly a fishing organization, but you're saying you're seeing a membership that's drawn to the environmental impacts.
Absolutely, yep.
This is the hardest question I have, and I don't know if it's even a fair question, but I'm going to put you on the spot with it. If Florida is going to be successful long-term, water quality, habitat-wise, we have to fill in the blank. What do we have to do? What does success look like? Is it a single thing? Is it a amalgamation of a lot of talk about that. Like you're the you're
yeah. No, I think I really think I mentioned this before, and I think it's critically important. Is we have to fix what we're doing on land. People just don't realize. The impact that they can have. For instance, there's homes on the west side of Interstate 95 that, when you flush a toilet, it's going to make it out to the Indian River. And somebody that lives there, they don't have any clue that
right.
can happen. We know that. We know where the major problems are, the issues. Like I said, the outdated wastewater facilities, the septic tanks that need to be
fertilizers,
updated, fertilizers, all that we have to change what's going on land, our runoff, like I mentioned before, Brevard County, and I think they just completed one of the biggest baffle boxes east of the Mississippi. Those are treating the stormwater before it makes it into the lagoon.
Explain what a baffle box is.
Well, I'm not an engineer, but
sure.
it's basically it's like a little catch basin that collects the stormwater and allows it to retain in the basin or I'm not sure how the engineering of it works, but basically with the water that comes out of there is way cleaner than the water that goes in from the streets. All that stuff together really makes a big difference.
It's like it adds a step into the stormwater treatment almost.
It does.
Like it catches that water
yeah.
and allows it.
Right.
Almost like miniature stormwater treatment areas.
Exactly. And so all that stuff is critical. And at the same time, we can't stop. Now I've heard people say, well, why are we bothering with habitat restoration when we have all these other issues. We have to be doing this stuff simultaneously because it helps. You know, well, we got these filter feeders going in the Indian River and say the clam project or oyster project. While, you know, we're cleaning our act up on land, those are also working too. It may not be perfect conditions, but it's going to help us get to where we want to get a lot faster. So it's a combination of all of that. Awareness, education to the public. You know, like I said before, some people have no idea what impact they're having on the environment. And so education has to play a huge role in it, informing people about what their pesticides and herbicides are doing downstream and things of that nature.
No, I think that's a really good word, and especially when you start talking about, I think it was Aldo Leopold that said, and I'm going to butcher this quote, but it was something like, if you take care of the land, the water will follow. I'm saying it
right.
It's something along those lines, but he said that back in the 50s, and it's exactly what you're echoing, right?
Like it is.
The idea
without
of
a doubt.
We have to take care of what's happening on the land. And
right. And it's what I was saying, it's not a quick fix, but we also, you know, everybody wants to live in Florida. And so our population's growing every week. I've heard the number of 1,000 people a week or something like that. I mean, it's a lot of people. And so we have to be able to keep up with that and get ahead of the curve. It just seems like we're playing catch up everywhere. We need to get ahead of the curve because we live in the fishing capital of the world, and you know, it's true. And people come here to recreate and enjoy the beaches and fish and dive. And you know, if we lose that, you know, we've lost everything.
We got to become more proactive versus reactive.
Exactly.
Frank, if people want to find out more about what CCA Florida is doing, where can they go? How do they learn more?
Well, certainly go to our website, ccaflorida.org. Definitely encourage that, or join CCA.org. Like I said, your membership dollars really matter, and we are using it for the right reasons, and you know that I've mentioned already.
All right, Frank, thank you so much. We'll make sure, hopefully everybody will sign up with CCA Florida. We talked to Lisa a while back about the Star Tournament. You can kind of see how this is all interconnected together. You join CCA, you can participate in the Star Tournament, but you can also tactily touch conservation efforts that you guys are working on, which
right.
I think is a powerful thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. It all goes hand in hand with the advocacy too, and our advocacy portion of our organization. I mean, with you know, in order to have the healthy fish stocks, we need to have the habitat and the water quality. It all goes hand in hand.
And I won't make you say this, I'll say this. I don't, and this isn't to deride another organization, but I don't know where else you'll see as tactile habitat restoration, putting dollars in the water, so to speak. As with CCA, and obviously you guys are working with a lot of other organizations to make that happen. So kudos to you guys. Thank you for all the work you're doing. And thank you for sitting down and joining us.
Absolutely. Glad to do it.
Thanks to Frank for his time and CCA Florida for rolling out the red carpet and letting us get in some interviews in over there. We really enjoyed doing it. If you are a fan of the podcast and what we're doing, we really appreciate your support. And there's a few ways you can do that. One of the easiest ways is by telling a friend about it. The best way people find out about podcasts is through word of mouth. So that's the best advertising we have, is you telling a friend about it. But another way you can do it is sharing the show. We put a post out on social media every week. You can share that in various groups or with your friends or Messenger or however you can get it in front of other people. Something else we offer is a Patreon, which is almost like a public radio type deal. We do have ads, but they're only ads from advertisers that already listen to the show. We don't go out and solicit ads, and we will never run ads for brands or things that are connected to the outdoors industry, because we want to be really authentic about that. So we have a thing called Patreon, and you can click in the show notes, which are the notes with this show, and click the link and become a patron of the show for $3 a month, up to $8 a month. And it's just a way to help us out with hosting costs and all the work we're doing, traveling up and down the road, equipment, the whole nine yards. We appreciate that. Also, you can check out our store at castandblastfl.com. Click on the store link, and you can support us by buying any kind of shirts or merchandise or anything else we have there. So hope everyone has a great week. We will see y'all next week, and later. Swell with love.